Post-Harlan Monologics. Number 00070. Recorded on March 5, 2024. Production location, Post. Harlan. Texas. Duraxicology Part 1. Duraxicology Part 1. Chapter 70.
The opinions of Maverick 88 are not necessarily the opinions of Maverick 88. Sensitive content warning. Viewer discretion is advised.
Now, buckle up. You are on the runaway train of thought. Ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, the one, the only, Maverick 88.
Recorded live before no studio audience from the F-150 Mobile Studio in an undisclosed location in the city of Wylie, Texas. This is Post Harlan Monologics and I am your host, Maverick 88. And I gotta tell you, you know, we finally start getting a couple of good weather weekends, right? Fair weather weekends where we can get out and do some stuff, right? And this weekend, we got out west to Weatherford, west down I-20, Weatherford, Texas, a city that my wife really likes to go to. We go a couple of times a year for odd things here and there. This time we went for the first Monday trade days, right? The flea market in Weatherford. We didn't know existed. We found out at another flea market that, in fact, it does exist. We went out there as part of a line of events that we wanted to attend to out there. I also took my wife out to a lunch at a old-timey mom-and-pop shop cafe about 10 miles south of Weatherford. Called Mary's Brazos Cafe, and we basically made a little bit of a day, you know, like an afternoon of it, right? And it was a good weekend with my wife. I just felt good all the time, and even in retrospect, even as I move forward into the work week, right, the pleasantness of our fondness for one another and just our ability to get along in all situations, it just rests so easily on me. It's a good thing. It's a wonderful thing. Maybe the best thing I've ever known in my life in this world, short of the Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ himself, right? And I do believe that my wife is a gift of God, a gift from God for me. And I do believe that I'm a gift for her equally, right? But I just walk away from the weekend with such a good feeling. And there was nothing spectacular that occurred that made this happen. It's just the fact. It is what it is. And it's always this way. And, you know, I guess maybe it's the onset of spring. I finally found my first mangy, decrepit old daffodil bloom here in the parking lot at work. You know, that's kind of what I go by spring. It's like the last daffodils to actually bloom, if they even do. But when they do, that's it. There's no more winter, right? It's been spring here for a good 3 weeks, easy, solid, possibly four, right? Really, from Valentine's Day till now. It has been spring, uninterrupted. We had one thunderstorm, one day where the temperatures dropped into the 50s with rain and clouds and everything. And then it just went right back up, 60, 70, 80. We've been in the 90s already. It's been spring. But this damn, it's a line of daffodils, and two of them decided that they were going to pop this year out of like 8 or 10. You know, some of them do, some of them don't. They've probably been in the ground there since 1990. You know, they're just old. They don't look like daffodils when they bloom. They're just, I don't know how to describe it, but they are old-timers for sure, right? So we went to the Weatherford Flea Market, and we liked it. We liked it. It was cool. It was mostly traditional with a couple of odd, what I call corporatized vendors, right? What I mean by that is somebody who purchases at bulk rate, at wholesale rates, to resell. And they go to flea markets to do their reselling, so they don't own a brick and mortar store or anything like that. The low overhead of just hauling stuff around, which actually ain't so low with the gas prices as high they are as they are, thanks to the Bidenomics, right? Don't get me going with that. But you know, I did meet some people. You know, it turns out a lot of people in Arkansas like to mosey over to Texas and try to sell their wares here. I met one guy who called himself the Handleman, for example. The Handleman. And I don't know how he substantiates the effort to drive from Arkansas all the way out to Weatherford, Texas, to spend a weekend selling wooden, you know, hickory wood handles, right? They are manufactured, you know, in Arkansas, local to him. And he buys them up and brings them out. I don't know who's going to buy the handles. I really don't. Oh, I just so happen to have an axe with a broken handle, and oh, I'll take a handle. It could happen. You know, I guess it does happen. The guy's there. The guy's always there. But anyway, he's just an example of like a reseller, right? There's a lot of like yard ornament type of stuff, very colorful. Parrots and cacti and lizards, these things that are made out of like sheet iron and or sheet metal, and you know, they're mass produced in Mexico. They're bought at wholesale rates and then they're sold at these flea markets. I don't really ever see people buying them anymore. They were kind of like 10-12 years ago, you saw that kind of shit on people's front lawns around here, but not so much anymore. I mean, hardly ever. I can't even think of anywhere. Like, nobody in my neighborhood's got that stuff on their lawn, for example, and I just don't see it. I always see them trying to sell it, but I don't see who buys it. But it used to sell a lot more. But that's another example of somebody who's buying wholesale, right? A flea market should be somebody who's like, it just has a lot of junk. Somebody who goes to like garage sales and buys. That is reselling technically, but you're not purchasing wholesale to resell, right? You're going and actually finding stuff that you think that you can resell for 50 cents, a dollar, you know, more than what you paid for it, and provide the service of a little treasure hunt of junk trinkets to somebody who might have a hidden interest in this stuff, right? That's what a flea market always was all about. Now, you're going to get the odd people in there who are going to come in and try to make a life out of it, right? And it is what it is, right? It is what it is. You know, we saw like the typical stuff that you'd expect to see. I mean, we walk out of it regarding it as mostly traditional, a lot of junk items. We go in there, we're looking for A, whatever, B, we're looking at like old westerns, like, you know, Clint Eastwood movies and things like that on DVD that you get for a dollar or two, you know, three for five. They're dirt cheap, and then those are the type of movies that seem to be timeless, right? I mean, they come from a particular historical era, but the stories in them are very basic, very plain, against very desolate backdrops. And you could watch them again and again. I mean, you wouldn't watch them every week, but you could watch them every year, right? And we got a good pile of them going. So that's something. We'll grab up a couple of old westerns like that since we've already got a collection going. And now that we've got the PlayStation 3 video game console, if we see PS3 games, we'll look through those. You know, just odd stuff. We may never get to play in them, right? But we'll have them. If you get them now, they cost, again, they're like nothing. $3, $4, $5, maybe $10 if it's a popular game, you know. Some of them brand new in the wrapper. They're just outdated, right? They're outdated, but not for people like my wife and I. That's kind of where I left off with video games. The only reason I played them back then was because I had kids in the house, right? I was stepfather to a couple of teenage boys in the PS3 era. So they were playing Call of Duty, and they were playing Grand Theft Auto, and they were playing Need for Speed, Most Wanted. And so I played these games with them. I watched them while they were playing. And so that's as far as I got with video games. I could just pick up right there and be good with it. My expectations technologically have not evolved from 2015 till now, right? That's as far as I got with that. So we're fine. That's the kind of stuff that we will look at. I always look at knives, but flea market knives, again, it's these, you get these resell people. They buy all these Chinese knives, and they lay them out on the table. They get them at wholesale costs, and they try to sell them to you. They're worthless almost always, you know. They're good for, like, a meal, and then they start falling apart. Yeah, you know, it's terrible garbage. But the kids all walk up. They're all bright and shiny and colorful. Ooh, ah, they got these shapes and designs to them. They look, quote-unquote, badass. And the kids don't know any better. They don't know what's good and what's not good. You know, when you look for knives, you look for the guy who's handcrafting something. And I found a guy there, right? He also was from Arkansas. He wasn't local. You would expect to go to, like, a kind of country town out beginnings of West Texas, right, heading out that way, and yeah, you might have, like, the local knife enthusiast who crafts his own cutting tools, and nah, that's a guy comes in from Arkansas, but he wasn't selling what he made. I asked him. He has, like, four or five buddies who do that, and he goes out and sells them for him. That's the racket. But he had handcrafted, Arkansas-made fixed blade knives that he probably should have been selling for like $125 with nice sheets, nice leather sheets and everything. And they were only like $50. Like, what the hell's wrong with them, right? What the hell is wrong with them? I mean, they had the Damascus steel and everything. I don't know. I guess they're hobbyists out there, maybe out in the backwoods, and $50 is better than nothing if, you know, they can move them. I would have bought one if I had any need for another fixed blade knife. I have so many of them now, right? But that's the kind of stuff I look for. And I also want to find old American pocket knives, right, that I can fix up. You know, something that's a little rusty, dull blade. If you clean it up, sharpen it up, it's still good. And I don't even want it for reselling. I just want it to have, right? Fix it up and now it's mine. And you used to be always able to pick through stuff like that, right? You can find it at most flea markets, a little here, a little there, but just not very much anymore. Those are things that I look for. So every time I see knives on the table, I go scooting for the knives, you know, and my wife comes following after me, and we start looking through. I got the eye. I'm very quick, you know, up China, 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 China. I don't even have to see made in China or anything like that. I could just tell looking at it. That's Chinese crap. And I understand who this guy is selling this stuff. You know, he's not a collector of knives. He's a reseller. Let's move along. Anyway, not to bag people. People got to make their money. That's fine. I walked out of there with a weed popper, right? We found some Westerns and we found some video games. And I got me a brand new weed popper. Well, it's a weed popper. Let me tell you, it's a device, right? It's a forked device. It's got like four or five prongs to it. And you stick those prongs in the ground into the roots of a weed, right? And the prongs are on the end of a pedal, which is attached to a stick with springs. And you step down on the backside of that pedal, the prongs lift up and pop the whole weed out, right? A weed popper. And we actually have one, right? These are old school tools, old school hand tools. But I never even heard of them. You know, it's like you had weeds and you had the weed, you had to get down on your knees and you had to scoop them up with a little shovel or something. You know, you had to dig in there, get on your hands and knees. It sucked. Everybody hates weed. These things make it cool. It's actually kind of fun. It's like, yeah, you bastard, I got you. All one shot. Didn't have to bend over. Didn't have to get dirty. Didn't have to get sweaty. None of that, right? So we actually had one at the house. We were using it two Saturdays ago. Take up dandelions. Take up sow thistle. and worked great. The spring came undone on it and couldn't really get it set right. You could still use it without the spring. The spring was really luxurious, but it's still, you could get it done. It's just a little bit more of a pain in the ass, a little extra effort that you got to put in. And lo and behold, we walk out, $3. I got a new one, right? It's not brand new. It's like new. And now I go pop some more weeds with it. Right? It's like the weed popper. You know, you had the food court and everything. Well, speaking of weed, right? Speaking of weed, we popping weed. The flea market, you know, has its fair share of what I call the quote-unquote stivics. Right? The stivics. Old school people begin to have an idea what I mean by that. What is a stivic? Right? A stivic. Stivic is Michael Stivic from the television show All in the Family, right? He's Archie Bunker's son-in-law. He is the quote-unquote meathead, right? That's the nickname that Archie Bunker gives to Michael Stivic. And he also is referred to as the quote-unquote Pollock, right? So, but what he is, he's like the late 60s, early 70s academic hippie man, young man, hippie young, hippified young man, who's like the counter to Archie Bunker. Archie Bunker, of course, is a crass, racially oriented, low IQ emblem of what appears to be the emblem of the, like, quote unquote, common middle class white man in an era where so many of the sitcoms were racially oriented, right? So he was the bad guy, right? He's the anti-hero of the television show, the father of a family, a show called All in the Family. And his antagonist was this Michael Stivic, hippie dude, who married the guy's daughter, Gloria, who was hip and with it. And they were a completely different generation from the old stodgy World War II generation represented by this Archie Bunker character, right? So when he would say something that seemed like racist, they were there to poke at him and tell him what's correct, how wrong he is to be the way he is, right? And they're very annoying people, very annoying character, right? And so Stivic is... he's like the hippie kind of guy, but he's also like the loaf, right? He eats all your food. He lays around the house all day. Maybe he's got a job. Maybe he ain't got a job, right? Very soft. He's doughy. But he's got this holier-than-thou attitude because he's culturally modern, right? Because he's culturally modern. Like a social justice warrior of the 70s type. Right, him and his wife alike. And, just to me, a very annoying character. Very annoying character. The fact that why do I bring him up? The flea market is loaded with these people, right? Not loaded, but every flea market's got them. If you walk through, you see the fat guy with the long, greasy hair, the beard that's all kind of askew, not kept, and fat, sweaty. And he's selling CBD, and he's selling gemstones, and he's selling candles and occult stuff, and it's always the same thing, and it's like always the same person. It's such a stereotype, but there he is, and I call that guy the Stivic, right? He's the Stivic. Don't be a Stivic. Don't be a Stivic. Don't get me started on Don't Be a Stivic. Maybe I'm started. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. But it was a good flea market. I don't mean to bag it, right? There's some things that are absolutely normal about it. There's some things that are absolutely traditional about it. There was only two things that really sucked, right? One of them is parking, right? So that's kind of like, that's what you get for having a good flea market. People are going to show up. So parking was difficult, right? They don't have a huge parking space, parking lot. For it, you just got to do what you got to do. Once you get parked, it's not much of a walk, you know. Everything is kind of small, close proximity, but a lot of vendors, right? And it was good. It was a good time. And we got out of there. We got out of there and went down to the Mary's Brazos Cafe. I guess it's 10 miles due south of Weatherford. Not hard to get to at all. Down Tintop Road, which splits into Old Tintop Road and New Tintop Road. But before you get right at that split, there it is. Mary's Brazos Cafe. And it's just a mom and pop shop. Ordinary, get your chicken fried steak. You know, that kind of place. And it was good. The portions were good. It was not very expensive. It was good. It was just a very good day, you know. Like maybe except for, on the way back, I was driving through I-20, South Dallas, coming around the bend where it meets into 635. And I was just raging through traffic, right? I was just raging. After a few hours driving, you know, out in the country and everything, and you come back and you're in the city again, and everybody's an idiot. All the lanes are blocked. Everybody's going 10 miles under the speed limit. If everybody would just do the golden rule of driving, drive right, pass left, everybody's moving. There's an open lane to go for people who really got to get. And I really had to get. Why? Just because, right? I don't need a reason. I just need the inspiration. And if I feel like I got to get somewhere, please get the hell out of the way. Right? And I understand. You got slow drivers around there that are annoyed by people who are actually in a hurry to get somewhere. And they think it's their responsibility to block the lanes and slow them down. And I know that like the Stivics of the world, for example, one very good example, they take it as personal responsibility to control the flow of traffic on the roads. They are human moving roadblocks that try to keep you from getting anywhere, right? They're no different than your son-in-law loafing on the couch without a job. That's who they are on the road, right? And it pisses me off. I just get so sick of it. You know, get the hell out of the way. And I just started driving with aggression. The jersey came out, right? And I'm not saying I was angry. I just riled a little bit. And my wife was actually scared of how aggressive I was going. And, I don't mean to make her feel scared, threatened, or anything like that. So I feel bad about that. But I felt good about cutting off so many people in the process. I know I was pissing people off who had pissed me off first. It's not my goal in life to avenge every offense. But sometimes when I'm driving, I just get to be in that way. You know, forgive me, Lord. I confess before you and everybody who listens to this, all right? The rage that I feel in traffic. It's an ongoing thing between my priest and I, right? When I confess, this is always on the list. So except for that, it was a very pleasant Saturday. And maybe, you know, I was sick again last week. Go figure. In the past year and a half, right? I've never been sick more frequently than I have in the past year and a half in all my life. I don't get deathly ill. It's almost the same illness every single time. It's very weird. It's like I get the same sickness over and over and over again. The symptoms present the same way, almost invariably. I get over it very quick, but I get like a little bit of everything that comes by. My body conquers it. You know, there's something going around work that's evil. People have had it for like 3-4 weeks. It won't leave them alone. They're losing their voice. Their voice is all froggy and the manager of this place, I refer to as the toad, right? Because she's got a froggy voice to begin with. Now she's got like a froggy on top of a froggy. It's like a frog ate a frog. And oh my God, I don't know what keeps me from cracking up in front of her every time she opens her mouth. But you know, I hold my cool. I hold my cool. Yeah, but I was sick 3 days out of work, 3 days last week. And then Saturday when the weekend came, I got up. Well, I had to do yard work. Go figure, right? Because I talked about the weed popper. Well, wasn't really popping weeds this time around. What we was doing was mowing down the dandelions from hell. Oh, my God. I was popping the weeds the previous Saturday in the front and then around the side and out back. We just have a jungle of dandelions going. Mowed them all down. That's the end of that, right? Wrong. By Monday morning, right? From Saturday morning to Monday morning, those weeds came back and they grew 3 times taller. They were over 12 inches in length, right? Somewhere between 12 and 18 inches in length. These dandelions, in 2 days, they grew that quick. Incredible. After I mowed them down, right? So this past weekend, mowing them down again, and we got out the weed and feed, right? Weed and feed is like guaranteed to kill dandelions as well as other things. But like they advertise like dandelion on their marketing. So that's, we're killing them off. And you know, so I spread that all over the yard and waiting to see what the results are. There's still some living dandelions back there, but they ain't coming back with the vengeance that they did last week. So I may just have to mow what's left down again and cover them up again, and that'd be the end of it. I don't know. I'm watching. But man, the dandelion situation has been absolutely horrendous in my neighborhood, right, Mayor? I got it from my neighbor. I got a young neighbor, right? A guy next door. He's living there with his young wife, and they got a kid. He used to be there with his mother and his sister before the wife and the kid came along. And I don't know that he knows about maintaining a yard. His backyard got like this, just covered with weeds all the time, and he rarely mow it, you know? Rarely would he mow it. And when my yard got, well, my lawn in the back got killed by these two summers of mini droughts, all his dandelions and weeds blew over there, and that's what settled in and grew, right? There was no grass there to choke them out, so he's spreading around the neighborhood. But, I mean, this is happening. This is the ugly scape season, right? This is the first dandelion finally popped. That time before that dandelion pops and spring actually begins, you've got this time in Texas where it ain't winter anymore. It ain't spring by the calendar. It ain't spring by the daffodil. But all the wheat, you know, you got a lot of things that are still dormant. A lot of different grasses are dormant. The trees haven't budded yet. And the weeds, though, they're ready to roll. All you need to do is drop some water down, throw some sun down, and these weeds just start right up. They don't care what calendar date it is. They don't give a shit. They're ready to go all the time. So what you end up with is the ugly scape. You have brown everything except the weeds that are popping up are all green. So they really stand out. It looks like shit. It looks terrible, right? And we end up, you know, last year it was like a really, really ugly, ugly scape because of all the different weeds, and it was a real prevalence of the sow thistle, which is horrible, right? Horrible, ugly looking. There's a bunch of that around now, but it ain't gotten tall yet. And I've killed most of it off in my yard. So it's not as ugly as it was last year, but these dandelions are crazy. They're like on steroids. They're growing in clusters of like a dozen. Their stems are as thick as drinking straws, and they're growing to heights well over a foot tall. And they're doing it in 2 days. It's ridiculous. Can't keep up with them, and the dandelion situation, just horrendous. And all this dandelion situation stuff, it rolls a song in my head that I swear I haven't heard since I was like 16 years old, right? I used to have, I think all in all, just two Rolling Stones albums, right? And they were both greatest hits. They were actually like a there was a Hot Rocks, right? It was a really, really good album. And then there was a More Hot Rocks. And on the More Hot Rocks, there was a song called Dandelion, right? Right? The Rolling Stones Dandelion song, which was, it came out in 67, the year I was born. The Summer of Love, right? I came out in the spring before the Summer of Love. I was a pre-love child, right? But then instantly thereafter, love came along, right? So it was like the heart of the psychedelic hippie era, right? Which really sprung up like in 65 with the whole folk rock thing and the anti-war protests beginning, the post-JFK assassination era in this country, which I worshipped when I was a teenager, and I hate and detest now, right? I've grown. I've matured, right? I've matured on the matter. I am no fan of Stivic, but as a teenager, I was well on my way to becoming one. Let's just face it, I was one. I don't want to admit it. I really don't want to admit it, you know? The inner man, right? Because I got the inner nerd and the inner Schneider. I got an inner Mexican. I've got all these inners inside of me, but the actual inner man, the man inside of me, looks at that Stivic and just backhands him upside the head and gives him the what for, points a finger at him, tells him to get up off the damn couch, right? Like my father used to do to me. The inner man. Anyway, the Stones' Dandelion song, right? It wasn't actually on a studio release album. It was a B-side of some other song, which and that's how they released it in England. But over here in the United States, it was popular enough that they made it its own A-side single, the Dandelion song. It's just called Dandelion, Rolling Stones' Dandelion. It appears on a couple of different greatest hits compilations. The one I had was More Hot Rocks, right? I had Hot Rocks and then More Hot Rocks. And that'll cover most of your Rolling Stones needs. That was a pretty good set of collections right there. I was never the huge mongous Rolling Stones fan, but it was always the argument, Rolling Stones or Beatles, right? You may have heard me say that before. It said a lot about who your character, your personality as a stoner was back in the day. You more the Rolling Stones type or you more the Beatles type? I was always more the Rolling Stones type. Even if I didn't listen to them a whole hell of a lot, right? And I did listen to the Beatles a whole hell of a lot, but I was never the Beatles type, right? I was just never that guy. I was always a little rough around the edges, and that's that, you know? In fact, you know, I bring this song up, Dandelion, right? The Dandelion song by the Stones. I believe I heard or read somewhere along the line that a couple of the guys in the Beatles actually sung some of the backing vocals in that song. The song was very different for the Rolling Stones, very different. It was really, really primo hippie psychedelic shit, right? I don't mean that it was all trippy. It was just all, how do you say it? Psychedelic hippie garbage, you know? Just all the flower power and all that. It was very like inner child. Like, it was a weird perspective. It was like a person talking to himself as a younger child. Telling about dandelions, right? Like the seed head dandelions, the type that you blow and then seeds scatter out, right? And the song talked about this dandelion game. I think it's somewhere, somehow, like similar to the old She Loves Me, She Loves Me Not, right? That was an old, I think, a French game that they did with like daisies or something like that, right? You pull the petals out, she loves me. And then you pull another petal out, she loves me not. And when you get all the way around, you get to the last petal, it's either she loves you or she don't, right? Or he loves me not, if you're gay, or, you know. Because everybody gets the dandelions and the lilies and, you know, because it's flower power, right? Psychedelic hippie garbage, you know. But it talked about like the dandelions being wise, right? Like you blow everything out into the wind and the dandelion don't tell no lies. I don't really understand like exactly how that works, but how it feels, how I sense it as I go through the lyrics of it. And I used to like the song when I was a kid, right? So I'm familiar with it and I've contemplated it a bit, but I haven't in so long. It's almost like taking the components of your composition, right? Like we're all developed. We're all raised with some sort of discipline, generally speaking. There are exceptions, right? Some people are raised by wolves and shit, right? I'm not talking to you. But most of us are raised with some kind of structure in our lives. We have some kind of discipline. Even if it's a poor discipline, even if it's very lacking, there's some sort of structure in our lives that holds us together. It makes us who we are, our composition, our constitution. And this is a song about releasing all that, right? Letting it all go. That's the way I take it, right? You just throw everything to the wind, basically, and see what comes of it. And that's what so much of the theme, the psychological, the psychic theme of the hippie era was. Dropping out, right? Dropping out of society, breaking the norms. It all sounds cool, but it really ain't. It's really wicked. It's really evil. It's really stupid. It's really foolish. And I did it all. I didn't do it in the 60s. I was a baby. But I did it in the early 80s, right? I let go of everything. And it wasn't good. It wasn't good. It seemed good. It seemed cool. At the time, because, you know, the truth is the world sucks and there is reason for a soul to want to part ways with it, right? To go off. I used to fantasize of just running off to the Rocky Mountains where there was nobody and just going and living out there like Grizzly Adams, right? As a kid, 15, 16 years old. That was an ambition of mine. I was a total dropout from the world. Make no mistake about it. You know, and that inclination never really left me. I had this conversation with my wife the other day during the course of our great weekend. And there's still that part of me that just wants to pick up and go. I've always been that way. Now, I'm not going to. Now, I didn't mean to scare her in that regard. I mean, I scared her enough driving around in Dallas, but I don't want to make it look like, okay, I've done enough here, and now I'm ready to pick up and go. That's been a story of my life, right? And that's not the case now. I'm not leaving this, but I still got the desire, right? So there's still life left in me. I think that's a good thing, but I've also got maturity that knows that this is a good thing. I'm not leaving this. I'm not walking away from it. And if I do, if I should, if I must, she's going with me. It's not me going off on my own, as had always been the case otherwise, right? But ultimately, I mean, the Dandelion song is, as a weed is, it is garbage. It really is. It's psychedelic hippie garbage. It's an enticement to youth. It's like a song that sounds like it was made for little kids to listen to. The tone of it, right? It has something very childish about it, with a voice that seems to be cajoling very young people to forget about everything they know and open up to the unknown. That is creepy. That is creepy. The whole hippie music thing, right? The whole hippie scene, all that is just, it irks me. I used to be so fascinated with it, so enthralled with it. There remains yet a fascination, but it's not what it used to be. It's the opposite, right? It's a study in the insanity of the world, where it used to be something that I admired, right? Now it is something that is horrifying. Hippie music, right? Like that. It's born out of, well, a few things. Like folk music, for example. Folk music originally was like the toil of the working man. It could come in forms that's a little bit country, right? Maybe a little bit blues. Those kind of things, they qualify, you know, as Americana, as the folk stories of America. But like the actual quote-unquote folk music, right? There's music that is about folks, and then there's folk music. Folk music was a co-opting of that kind of music that described the toil of the working man, right? Co-opted by who? Communists. Communists, because they suck and they're everywhere. They're like the fire ants that you step on the nest, and the next thing you know, they're all up your leg. Where they come from, I don't know. But they're in every city, they're in every university. And we've had difficulty in the United States with that element of people for the past 100 and about 5 years now, right? Right around 1920 or so, they started making hay in San Francisco first, right? The longshoremen, the unions out there, they started getting into the colleges out there. And as they got established there, then they kind of replicated over in New York and Greenwich Village. Greenwich Village was the folk music communist bastion, which of course became the gay bastion, you know, because they all seem to tie together. And I'll get into that, right? I'll get into that. The hippie music was part that folk thing. It was part like I was talking about, the Stones and the Beatles, right? The British invasion, which I think is literally an invasion. That was a cultural invasion by the known mortal enemy of America, right? Britain. From the beginning, the revolution was against them. The War of 1812 was against them. Guess what? The Civil War, when you really look through the history and figure it out, put it all together, it was really about, again, the damn Britain, the Brits, and their Zionist brethren over there trying to subvert the federal structure of the United States, right? They were continually, look, Britain could not maintain any kind of control over the colonies. They lost the Revolutionary War. They tried it again in 1812. They couldn't do that, and they would figure, what are they going to do now? What are they going to do now? Well, they really didn't want to control everything. What they wanted to do was loot the place, right? So how could we loot it? Bring a central bank in, right? So they worked to get the central banks in, and they struggled to get that done. It really wasn't happening. They had an opportunity at it, maybe even a second one. It wasn't taking. A new president would come in, like Andrew Jackson, for example, and poo-poo it, shut it down. And, the assassins would start aiming at these guys, try to kill them, right? I think I've talked about this before, very recently, in fact. It's on my mind, right? It's on my mind for sure. But the Brits were always the enemy of America until they finally got their way, until they got the central banking system through the Federal Reserve in place. Then we become buddies, right? Then we become buddies because they owned us. They owned politicians, and the rest is history. For almost that same 105 years, it actually goes back for 110 years or 115 years. Our history now, right, is corrupted from that point forward. You know, first the Brits with their Zionist cohorts got the central bank into place, and then the communists came in after that to do what? Destroy the culture. And part of the destruction of the culture involved the British invasion of music in the 60s. Think it through. If you don't believe me, think it through. Put it all together. Maybe when you're done listening to everything I've got to say on the matter here, you might see it differently, right? So you had the folk music, which was co-opted by communists. You had the British invasion, which again is coming from the mortal enemy of the United States, Britain. And then you got the folk rock, which was the combination of the two, right? You had the folk scene, the communists, and the faggots in Greenwich Village, right? Which included the Mamas and the Papas, right? The early iterations of the Mamas and the Papas. They were part of that folk scene in Greenwich Village, New York City, where I used to go to when I cut school when I was a teenager and sit there and smoke weed and watch the Jamaicans beat the piss out of each other. True story. Actually, it was blacks and Jamaicans. It wasn't just the Jamaicans, but yeah. I actually got arrested in there for drinking in public when I was 16 years old. I don't want to go down that road again. But anyway, folk rock, right? That folk scene had their eyes open with this sudden and very crazy, strange popularity of this band from England called the Beatles, right? You had the Beatles were the big introduction to the British invasion music. They landed in New York City, and there was, of course, if you know the story, you know the history, a hype machine was built up around the Beatles, right? All the screaming girls and everything like that, that was made up. I'm not saying it didn't happen. I'm saying it was fabricated. Girls were paid to come and do this. That they were enticed to come and do this. They made these big crowds at the airport when the guys come off the jet, and all the crazy fandom around there. It was manufactured. And you know how pop culture is. If you see somebody screaming about some star, it becomes contagious. And I never understood that, right? I never understood that. But that's the way we are, apparently, at some level. So there was a manufactured hype to it. But with that hype, it opened the eyes of the people right there in New York, right? Beatles land in New York. You got the folk scene in New York. Why are these guys so popular? What'd they do? They started to emulate those guys. They started to dress like them. They started to incorporate their music styles into theirs. So you had this amalgamation of folk music and rock as it was at the time, right? The Beatles represented the, what'd they call it? The Mersey Beat? I think the Mersey was a river somewhere. That type of English, British rock music, rock and roll. It was rock and roll, just a British type. Different than, say, Elvis, right? Different than Carl Perkins. The British had their own type. But that was incorporated into the commie folk music scene. And you made what was called folk rock. And then folk rock morphed into the psychedelic rock from there. right? So this is kind of like the weird history of it all, right? The whole weird history of it all. The folk rock, now you get into that psychedelic era, and then you start getting, you know, the dropout notion. And I'm going to get into this a little bit in a moment too, right? But the whole thing about like being that quote-unquote dropout, like a stivic, right? All this folk rock music and the psychedelic, it turns you into a stivic. You'll be a loaf, you know, a mushy, soft, pasty loaf on the couch full of social justice attitude, eating your donuts and barking commands at your mother to get this and get that, right? The guy I talk about, the knuckle fucker, right? There's my F-bomb. But that's a word. That's an actual dictionary word in the Maverick 88 dictionary. The knuckle fucker, right? The classic knuckle fucker is a stivic, right? And that hippie stuff, that psychedelic stuff, that whole dropout attitude turns you into a stivic. Hey, by the way, right? I mentioned about Stivic, Michael Stivic, comes from All in the Family, that relation with Archie Bunker. A spinoff, The Jeffersons was a spinoff show from that. The guy who was like the creator, producer of a large line of these types of 1970s situation comedies, right? Sitcoms. Dude named Norman Lear. And I'm not a fan of his TV shows, let me tell you. Kind of a fan of a lot of the characters, right? It's a weird thing. It's a weird phenomenon. The TV really sucked. It truly sucked. It was horrible. I can't watch it now. It's just so... what's the word? Pointed, you know? The social justice elements of it are just so in-your-face stupid, right? A clear, obvious attempt to channel society into leftist ideation. It's abhorrent. The shows were horrible, right? The characters, though, on the other hand, here's the irony. When all you had was three networks back then and a couple of local channels on your TV set, this is all you got to see. There was plenty of Norman Lear and Norman Lear type of sitcoms going on in the 70s. When you turn the TV on, you're going to watch them. That's all you got to go by. You didn't have options then like you have now. You didn't have videotapes, right? The old VCRs. You didn't have none of that. You didn't have DVDs. You didn't have cable TV. Right? You had antenna TV. It came in horribly, right? The quality sucked. But all you had was so much of this kind of stuff on TV. You would have to watch it if you were going to watch TV at all. And when you do, whether you like it or not, you start to get familiar with it, right? You could hate a TV show, but you could like a couple of the characters. A Norman Lear production, that serves a good example of this, right? Sanford and Son, right? Sanford and Son. I like Sanford and Son. I like the characters in it. I'm comfortable with them. The premise of the stories are often not so political, but they've still got that racial, social justice kind of crap happening along the way, right? Which really emasculates the effort, in my opinion. But yeah, this Norman Lear guy, All in the Family, Sanford and Son, the Jeffersons, like I said, One Day at a Time, which is where the inner Schneider comes from, right? Duane Schneider was from One Day at a Time. Maud, right? Maud, it was a spinoff of something. These were all Norman Lear creations through the 70s, right? And anybody has seen any of those shows. Nickelodeon, I think, the last I ever saw, was a long time ago, would play all these classic 70s and 60s shows, right? But Norman Lear is dead. He died last month or the month before. I failed to mention it, but I definitely did not fail to recognize it. So here, you know, I give you an idea of the productions that he made. Here's a little snippet from the Wikipedia, whatever that's worth, right? Online encyclopedia. Lear was known for his political activism and funding of liberal and progressive causes and politicians. In 1980, he founded the advocacy organization People for the American Way to counter the influence of the Christian right in politics, right? So, a literal antichrist. Hence my abhorration for the dude and his creations, right? And I resent the fact that I have such familiarity with Archie Bunker and Michael Stivic and Ann Romano and Dwayne Schneider and Fred Sanford and Lamont, right? I know all these people like they're friends of mine. All these characters, right? Like they're friends of mine because I was stuck watching them on TV when I was a kid. It's a real conundrum. It's a real conundrum. But hey, the dude is dead, so terrible television is now squarely in the hands of the millennials and I guess Generation Z, right? They're all lined up to make bad TV. Good for them. I don't watch TV, and this is the reason why I don't watch TV. Because of social justice bullshit, right? The pop culture elements. I don't need to be a part of it until a good 10 years after it has passed. And I can look at it in hindsight with wisdom and say, look at those stupid assholes. I do like to point the finger at the world and say, look at those stupid assholes. It's a part of me, right? It's a part of me. So, anyway, don't be a Stivic. Don't be a Stivic. I think about all those old sitcoms. And even some of the ones that are more recent, of course, by now old also, right? This 60s, 70s, especially the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s, and the 2000s, these sitcoms, and other types of shows too, not necessarily just sitcoms, there so frequently seems to be what I call the Jewish voice of reason, right? What I mean by that is there's this one character whose role among the other characters is the guy to explain everything, the guy who sets things right, basically the guy who makes the standards of behavior for the ensemble, right? The Jewish voice of reason. Let me give you an example, right? An example. Well, hell, Stivic himself, right? Michael Stivic in All in the Family, he's the Jewish voice of reason. Now, yes, Archie Bunker always calls him the Polak, right? But if you know a little bit about Jew culture in New York City especially, the Reform Jews, the atheist Jews, you know, non-practicing types, more, yeah, I guess you'd call it more liberal, right? The non-Orthodox Jews call the Orthodox Jews old Polaks, right? Because they bring that tradition, the Ashkenazi tradition out of Poland predominantly. So like in Brooklyn, you see those Hasidics running around with the black hats and the black suits and the white shirts. You know, they kind of look like waiters. They get referred to as old Polaks. So when you see Michael Stivic, and he's called the Polak, and the actor is Jewish himself, the son of another Hollywood actor or Jew. I put two and two together, and what I see there is a very subtle Norman Lear. Okay, Norman Lear himself was a Jew, right? There seemed to be this tendency to interject that, what I call, Jewish voice of reason into these television shows, right? That's one example, right? And if you don't buy the whole old Polak thing, right, for Orthodox Jews, try this one on for size. Go to Star Trek, not necessarily a sitcom, right? You can actually reach and say it sort of kind of is in a way, right? It's not done before the live studio audience and all that stuff, but anyway, Mr. Spock, the Jewish voice of reason. Now, he was a Klingon, right? Something different. He wasn't human like the rest of them, right? That's an example of a Jewish voice of reason. Of course, Leonard Nimoy was a Jew himself, a very prominent Jew, very much into his Jewish identity as a human being, you know, in his personal life. If that doesn't do it for you, this is a really good one, right? This is not Norman Lear, nor was Star Trek, but if you remember the show Taxi, right? You had Jim Ignatowski, who was Christopher Lloyd, right? The guy from Back to the Future, played the hippie, right? The spent all hippie dude. With a show that was only like 6-7 years past Woodstock, right? Anyway, on that show, Taxi, you had Alex Rieger. He is probably the best example of the Jewish voice of reason on that show. Everybody turned to Alex for advice. The guy is a freaking taxi cab driver, right? And he had no other interests in life. That's all he did. He was alone. He had no family. He had a divorce. He had a daughter that was estranged from him. He had no family life. He had no hobbies. All he did was drive this taxi. And he was in a crowd of people who were doing that workaday Joe job, like I do here, a workaday Joe job, but they had other aspirations. One woman was an artist. One was an actor, right? The guy was an actor. The guy was a boxer, right? Everybody seemed to have, like, the dream that they were pursuing. And they just did this taxi cab thing to carry them along until they reached their dreams, right? But then you had this guy. He had no dreams. He had no nothing. All he did was drive a taxi. But he was the person that everybody turned to for advice, for wisdom, right? He was like the wise sage of the group, the ensemble, the cast. And he was the Jewish voice of reason in that show. If it was only like one or two times that that happened in all these different shows, I could see like, all right, Maverick, you're crazy, man. I just run off, what, three of them? Very quick? Alex Rieger is a really good example, but the other two are very good examples also. But then, you know, like there was Rhoda. There was a spinoff from Mary Tyler Moore, right? Mary Tyler Moore. Rhoda Morgenstern, right? Now, the show was about her, so it focused on her, but she was kind of the voice of reason in that show. I don't remember that show all too much. I remember there was a doorman named Carlton who spoke through the intercom service that they had in the building. You might, if I remember, you might consider him a voice of reason, although he was kind of dopey. This might not be the best example, right? Here's a good one. Lilith Sternin on Cheers, right? Cheers. Remember Cheers? And you had Frasier Crane, right, who ended up having a spinoff show of his own, Frasier Crane. I used to get his seats at Yankee Stadium through my cousin, right? My cousin got his seats. That was his deal. He had the connections, right? He was the man. But every year or so, he would spin me off a couple tickets, and I sat in, what the hell's that guy's name? Oh, it sucks that I can't think of the actor's name. That's so bad. But anyway, the guy who played Frasier Crane on Cheers and also had his own show. Both of them were hit shows, hit sitcoms. But the woman who played his wife on Cheers, right, would come into the bar. She was the Jewish voice of reason on that show, too, right? Very logical. She's very Spock-like. Very Spock-like. You know, her personality, she really lacked a lot of personality. She was almost robotic. She was like almost like a living, walking computer. But everything was logic and reason with her, and she was like what I call that Jewish voice of reason on that show, amongst the ensemble. Just like with Rhoda, you know, the show starred her friend Fine on The Nanny. I remember seeing that show in reruns. I was not a big fan of it. She was a very annoying person. Again, star of the show. So is she really the voice of reason? Everything is from her perspective. Maybe that's kind of a little stretch, a little reach. And maybe also you could say the same thing about Seinfeld, right? You know, Jerry Seinfeld, he was definitely the voice of reason with all his zany friends that were always into hijinks, right? He was like the stability in it. But they were all kind of Jews in their own way, right? If they weren't actually Jews, they were very similar with Jewish identity. So that might be a stretch too. But do you get what I'm saying? And I don't know everything there is to know about TV. I just picked this up through the years. It just so frequently seems to be, you know, somebody coaching us all along into like what the actual morality, really the ethics of our American culture or collective pop culture really ought to be. You know, trying to reset the standards, right? There was a standard in this country. Now there was a reset of standards that were happening through the arts, and TV, television was a great medium to kind of present to people a way to live. You know, how many people in this world have learned so much of what they know through television, right? We learn to interact. We learn about other people. We learn about other cultures. It's really a powerful tool, and of course, put in the wrong hands, it could be destructive. And I happen to be saying now, I think that the misuse of media in general, particularly television, has been a destructive one. We've watched a cultural decline happen in this country from the onset of television, right? You could start in the 50s. We were in a golden era in this nation. And then there's just been a steady decline ever since, a walk away from morality year after year, of course, generation by generation. Everything seems to get a little more leftist, a little bit more communist, a little bit more radical, a little bit more perverse. And if you just put two snapshots together side by side, say 1950 and 2020, wow, you know, you've got bedlam. You've got such like a chiaroscuro, such a polarity of what it means to be American, right? Now, the progressives will call it progressive, right? Progress in the eyes of some. And it's the eyes of those who really want to destroy the place. That's progress. The eyes of those who want to maintain a standard, right? Now we go back to the whole Rolling Stones dandelion thing, right? You have a standard of living and you just blow it away into the wind, right? Just blow it away. Give up your constitution. Give up your character. Give up your framework. Give up everything that your being is built upon. Throw it up to the wind to see what might happen instead, right? It's like having a diamond in your hand and being given an option to keep it or select what's behind mysterious door number two. And for some reason, some of us are tempted to take what's behind the mysterious door number two. So anyway,
this monologue is continued in the next episode, Chapter 00071, Dirac Psychology, Part 2.
Thank you for tuning into Post-Stalin Monologics. Further information involving this project and archived releases of Post-Stalin Monologics can be accessed over the World Wide Web at poststalin.com. Comments, critiques, and inquiries may be submitted to Maverick through email at maverick88@poststalin.com.